Hello, podcast family. You're going to love this podcast interview. I had the great pleasure of talking with Augustine Colebrook. She is a midwife, a podcast host, an author, an entrepreneur, and a mother of many. Today's story has many vulnerable moments and emotional turns for Augustine, and I deeply thank her for coming on and sharing her story with us. Now let's get started. Welcome to the Journey to Midwifery podcast. This podcast platform is for midwives to tell their story. This is where you get to hear the how and the why a person is called on this journey to midwifery. I'm your host, Amber Wilson, a midwife myself, and I came up with this idea so that all those people asking these questions had a place to go to find answers. I hope you enjoy these stories as much as I enjoy recording them. So welcome to the podcast, Augustine. Say hello, give your intro.
Thank you so much for having me and inviting me. My name is Augustine Colebrook. I'm a midwife and a mentor and a muse. I like to be an inspiration for people. I've been a midwife for a while now, and it's taken me on really amazing adventures. I practiced in the US and internationally. And I'm currently in India. And I direct and run Midwifery Wisdom Collective, and it's an educational and consulting firm focused on the business and practice of midwifery. And I have some amazing teammates in that. And I'm also the president of the newly formed Global Alliance of Independent Midwives. And GAME is the acronym. GAME's first conference is coming up in May. And so I'm very busy planning conference, which is not something I thought I would ever do, but I'm loving it. I'm really excited to do this. And mostly I just, I really enjoy sitting in the birth space. I enjoy training new midwives. And I love that you put this podcast together. How fun to think about how to find this path. So yes. Thanks for inviting me.
As you know, there's many ways.
There are many ways. Yeah. And I thank you so much for inviting me.
Yeah. So we're going to get into why you got into midwifery, but are you still practicing birth?
I am. I'm the clinical director of one of the four birth centers in India. And we're in a rapidly growing phase. India sort of exported Western obstetrics and for-profit medicine in the 70s. And like what happened in the US in the 50s, kind of outlawed traditional midwifery as a competition to the new obstetrics paradigm. And so they're in a renaissance of bringing midwifery back. And in the north of the country, there's about 80 different languages all spoken in India. And I am not an expert in any one of them, so I don't know what I'm saying half the time. But the Dai, the traditional midwifery here, is making some return in the villages and in the rural areas of northern India. And in more modernized populated cities like Hyderabad and Kerala and Goa, there's birth centers. And that's where I am, is in Bangalore, which is the center of the southern part of the country. And it's really exciting to be a part of this this revolution of bringing birth back. And so we have a freestanding birth center here. And I have quite a few Indian midwife students now, helping them through the labyrinthine process of getting the info in your head, as well as seeing and doing enough to feel competent. So it's very exciting.
How in the heck did you end up in India? It's, I know we're going backwards, story, so I was, but I got to hear this.
I know. Well, so I was in Papua New Guinea when I was, actually it's West Papua in the island of New Guinea. I was there working for Bumi Sihat, which is an international NGO focused on women's health and gentle birth in Indonesia and the Philippines. And so they have a new clinic in Papua, and I was there helping to, you know, there's a lot of midwives in Indonesia, but they don't get any kind of physiologic training. So they are something like 40,000 graduate every year. It's an obscene amount of midwives in Indonesia, but they are obstetric nurses. They don't have a lot of autonomy. They don't have a lot of independence. They don't have a lot of critical thinking, big picture awareness, and they certainly don't get physiologic birth, gentle birth kind of orientation. So in this gentle birth clinic that is freestanding clinic, this was the sixth that Bumi Sehat has opened. I went to do a deeper dive into the balance between doing nothing and doing everything that is something I think the midwifery model of care does so well. And so I was orienting midwives and procuring staff, equipment and just sort of being a mentor there for that group. And then I got invited to go and help a European couple have a home birth, but also price shop and look for setting up a new clinic in Timor-Leste, which is a small Pacific Island country. And that was in February and March of last year. And it's a very rural, very isolated country. And I was very immersed in the work I was doing. And we were just kind of oblivious to what was happening in the globe. And one of the Australian doctors that I, befriended, I saw her one day and she was like, "So I'm leaving tomorrow." And I was like, "Where are you going?" She's like, "Oh, I'm going home." I was like, "Why?" She was like, "Well, the pandemic." And I was like, "What?" I had no idea. I mean, I really feel ignorant now, but I was supposed to go back to Papua, and in Papua, they carry machetes in the street and you have to be, I have to have a mentor or a person to take me to grocery shop. Like, I can't be there really alone. I certainly don't speak the language. And so I just started thinking, I was like, back there, if the world's about to shut down, I have to go be able to speak the language. That's the bottom line, right? So I just bought a ticket to the closest English speaking country, which was Australia. And I went there I've never been there and never knew anyone. And I sheltered in Australia for 6 months and randomly met amazing midwives in amazing places and had the most incredible time. But it was feel like it was running to an end of the whole process. And so I had planned to teach before the pandemic, a year before. I had tickets actually into India to teach in northern India at a nursing college, October 5th of 2020. And that's the day I got out of quarantine. So it's my trajectory stayed the same, even though it totally changed. It's so crazy. But anyway, the birth home, where I work now, they knew of me and they called me to see if my company could help them find a clinical director. I was like, I'll do it. So it's been an amazing adventure. I got officially hired and applied for a visa and bought a ticket and got a COVID test and traveled all in the span of 10 days during a pandemic. So it was totally unexpected and crazy, but it worked. And I've been here almost 5 months now, and we've grown rapidly, and it's really exciting. I mean, I just adore it. I'm so glad I'm here. Can't imagine being anywhere else.
Now I definitely have to hear your story from the beginning, because this is just wild. But before we do that, I want to say something you taught me on email that I had no idea is it's my nighttime and your morning time, but we're 10 and a half hours difference.
I know. India. And I think because of India's close ties with multiple finance sectors or something like this, they split the difference between the daylight savings shift that the US makes. And so they are always at the 10:30 mark. IST is always at the 30.
That's so interesting and quite clever.
Whether the U.S. daylight savings up or down, it means that basically Silicon Valley. So I stay in Bangalore. Bangalore is the Silicon Valley of India. It's a very up and coming tech capital. And there's direct flights to San Francisco. I mean, it is they're deeply connected. And so it's exactly 11 and a half or 12 and a half hours from San Francisco, depending on what time of year it is because of the daylight saving change. So IST is a fun place.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Okay, now go all the way back to the beginning. Why midwifery?
Why anything else is my question.
True. But why for you?
Yeah. I think my question or my answer involves some ethereal, some spiritual, some interesting, like unknown pathways. I mean, we could start all the way back if you want to get really crazy. We could start all the way back in my birth. My mother tried to have a home birth with me, with her midwife sister. And after 3 days of labor at home, she went to the local obstetrician to be checked because I guess family was worried about her. And so they drove 2 hours into town, and they were living in an off-grid hippie commune in West Virginia. And the doctor actually put a speculum in and opened her up and was like, oh, you're 8 centimeters. Go home and keep trying.
Oh, wow.
Which is him trying to be supportive of the crazy 70s like thing. But I'm on now, you know, this many years out of it, you know, I ordered as many records as I could, and I went deeply into the thing. And so my mother had gone to Puerto Rico to have a late term abortion a few years before I was conceived. And so she had scar tissue on her cervix. So yeah. She tried laboring at home for another 3 days. And when she was leaking black meconium with a high fever, they finally went to the hospital. And I was born by classical incision in a backwoods hospital in the border between West Virginia and Virginia. And I had seizures for the first 2 weeks of my life, and my mother had a raging uterine infection. We were both eventually airlifted to Cincinnati, Ohio, which had the largest NICU in Bethesda Hospital, you know, has, you know, and I was hospitalized for 2 weeks, and she was hospitalized for 2 months, and they gave her a shot to dry up her milk. And when she finally released, she called La Leche Leak and managed to relactate and figure out how to latch me, despite my very tremendous tongue tie. And you know, I think that there's something about that and adversity and that that sort of broken faith that I was born into, because of course they had read Ina May Gaskin and they had Le Boyer's book, and they had, you know, they had this deep faith. My mother tells the story of walking the circular rug in the living room and until she could almost pass out. She was so tired for days, just thinking like, it's got to come, it's got to come. And so I was born into this culture of fear around birth. And it was like an extra fear, because it was like faith lost kind of fear. And so my parents had a scheduled cesarean for my little sister. And then my mother got pregnant again, despite recommendations not to, because of a pretty significant uterine window in her scar. And with that third pregnancy, at this point I was 6. I was so excited for this baby coming home. And he never came home. My mother had a scheduled cesarean, but his gestational age showed that he was 4 weeks younger than the dates that she had. And he had significant lung immaturity, and in the 80s did not have surfactant therapy and the things that would have saved him today. And so he passed away at day 3. And I lived in a state of grief that I think most 6-year-olds don't get to experience. And my mother lived in such a state of trauma and grief that I effectively lost my parents in that experience. My father was, I think, doing all that he could to stay afloat, having lost his only son, and trying to help my mother. And my mother was never a particularly nurturing mother, but that was kind of the end of that for her, because she just retreated into herself. The backstory is she lost her mother at 13 and her father at 17, and she didn't have a great coping mechanism for grief and loss. But it was it was a very shaping experience for me. And just a year and a half later, her sister, the midwife's sister, was having her fourth baby, and they're very close. They live together now in their 70s. And, we went out for her sister's birth in Colorado, in the mountains of Colorado. And she had been practicing as a midwife for a number of years. In fact, Pam England was her midwife partner in Northern New Mexico and Southern Colorado. And, so some of her neighbor midwife friends came to her house, and she walked around and she squatted down and she pooped. And, you know, it was the coolest experience of my childhood life. And she pooped out her baby, you know, which is like my 8-year-old vision of it. And it was March in Colorado, and there were baby chickens and baby horses and baby cows and baby goats and baby puppies and baby kids. I mean, like everything on the farm. It was a big ranch in Durango, Colorado. Everything on the ranch was having babies, and it was all happening right there. And nobody went to the hospital, and nobody lost their baby. And so it was like this deeply shaping experience for me. I was like, oh, when you go to the hospital, you know, bad things happen. But when you stay home, it's really normal. And that's incredibly simple, oversimplified, but that is what my 8-year-old brain did. And so, you know, going forward, I lived in Europe for a year after high school, and I happened to be placed with a senior midwife in all of Jutland, the main peninsula of Europe, of Denmark. And you know, she didn't take me to birth, but she like just steeped me in this like normal experience. And I got to study some with her. And then I came back to the US and got married and got pregnant. And I was at the College of Charleston studying anthropology, and I happened to be in a class, Birth and Four Cultures was the textbook that we were required to read. And, you know, it was just like this reset button, right? From my early childhood experience, like from 8 years on, every exposure I got was like, this is the way. And so when I got pregnant, I was like, oh, I'll find a midwife. And I looked and I interviewed a midwife with really long red fingernails and a red mini dress. And she drove like a red Corvette. She drove up to my house, and I'll never forget. She had these like really shocking fingernails, like, whoa, kind of, I think they were even pressed on, like, I don't even know. And I was like, so how do you do an exam?
Yeah.
Like, how does this work? And she looks me right in the eye and she goes, don't worry, honey, I'll double glove. I was like, no, that's not going to work for me. I know there's a midwife for everyone, but that is just not my style. And I interviewed another lady, and she was like, oh yeah, totally, I'll take you. I mean, I'm going to be out of town the month you're due, but we'll figure it out. And I was like, no, that doesn't work for me either. So then I had visions of like, I'll drive to the farm. Ina May will be my midwife. And then of course I like figured out the distance. I was like, oh, 12 hours in the car in labor. That doesn't sound good, actually. So anyway, like it just sort of unfolded that I was 42 and a half weeks pregnant and still pregnant and still hadn't found a person. And I was like, I guess I'm doing this by myself. And my husband at the time was like, all right. And I was like, oh, you're as dumb as I thought. So we were living on the Air Force Base in South Carolina. And my mom came down to be with me. And bless her heart, she was trying to be so supportive, you know, trying not to put her fear on me. But she was literally terrified, you know. My neighbor had 3 natural births, and she came over and she was trying to be helpful, but she'd only had epidurals in the hospital. She didn't really know what was happening. And I labored for many days and delivered squatting in the living room. After, I don't know, 3-4 days of labor and pushing for hours and hours. And 43 weeks and 0 days, and my baby was 10 pounds even, and she breathed immediately. And it was perfect, and it was like the exact opposite of, you know, what I and my mother had experienced. And I'll never forget, like, I did actually kind of pass out. I felt very weak. I did lose a significant amount because I think I had a really rapid placental release. But I was laying on the floor of the living room, and my mother was spoon feeding me bites of of breakfast that she had made, and my baby was nursing on me. And my mother was just crying and crying and crying because this is what she didn't get, you know? And it was just like so intense. And I looked around and my neighbor kind of smelled of cigarette smoke and had been in and out of the house and like was not really present. And my husband was just sort of like, I don't even know what he was doing. I think he was like maybe sleeping in the corner. And my mother was just having this deep emotional process and couldn't quite even comprehend what was happening. And I was like, I really need a midwife. Like, where's the people that take care of me? Like, something's wrong here, you know? Like, I had just done this epic experience. And I was really grateful my mother was feeding me, like, you know, but she was having her own experience. Like, there was nobody that was present for me. And that was kind of the, I had read Ida Mae Gaskin, I had read Special Delivery, Rehuman Double. I mean, this was in the 90s, you know, there wasn't a lot of things, books available like there are now. But I was like, I'm going to study this. Like, I'm going to do this. This is like, I have to be my own midwife. And even in that moment, I was like, I have to take care of myself. And sure enough, like, I don't know, the next day or 2 days later, his mother-in-law showed up and we had to go out to dinner because she couldn't cook. You know, it's like, right, there's something wrong with this picture. You know? So I did everything I could to start this path. And, you know, I met as many people as I could and I studied as hard as I could and, eventually found an apprenticeship. And, you know, in South Carolina, there was a legal process for CPMs, but, there was a legal process, but it involved a very unspecified amount of apprenticeship time. And very shortly, within, I guess, maybe a year, my husband was transferred in the military and we got moved to New Jersey, which was illegal. So I had a very circuitous path to actually learning the clinical skills. I had 13 preceptors over the course of my training.
Lots of different perspective.
Yeah. And I think there's some benefit to that. I mean, I think I maybe had a little too many, but I think there's a lot of benefit to learning from multiple people. I think it's just as valuable to learn what not to do or what doesn't align with you as it is to learn what to do. And you don't get to get that perspective until you get multiple influences. So I'm a fan of multiple preceptors.
Yeah. I was holding my breath during your birth story. Yeah. I was so relieved when you said she breathed.
Yeah. I hemorrhaged. I did go to a WIC appointment on day 5 or whatever. It was like 4.6 or something terrible.
Oh my gosh. But are you kidding me?
I know. No, I'm not. I was like white basically for 2 weeks. Yeah, I had a very extreme initiation in this process.
Yeah.
All we can do really is be grateful for our pathways, right? But I feel really blessed in a lot of ways. There's a way that I approach birth that you can't get from book learning and you can't get from school. There's an understanding that I feel like I was imbued with that I'm really grateful for. I know what it's like to be the undisturbed laboring mom. I don't think everyone should be, but I know what it's like. And so it has helped me, I think, faster than most, find the balance in the practice between everything and nothing.
Can I ask if you had any more babies after her?
I did. I had a son who was 44 weeks and 11 pounds, 4 ounces.
You baked them a long time.
I baked them big and long. And that was its own kind of epic struggle with positioning and a cervical lip. And then I had a
baby. Did you have a midwife for that one?
I did not. Still in South Carolina. I didn't find anyone. And then for my third, I had... I had a collection of, I suppose, doulas, for lack of a better word, who cooked food and took care of my kids and rubbed my back and like gave me the juicy parts of midwifery, but I still didn't have any fetal heart monitoring or anything. But she was only 42 and a half weeks or something and only 9.5 pounds. And it was like easy,
baby. You know,
3 pushes, kind of great experience. that was in New Jersey. And I mean, I have a very conflicted relationship with unassisted birth. Like on one side, I am absolutely a champion for autonomy and sovereignty and self-determination. But I don't, from knowing many unassisted birthing families, I would say 90% or more are choosing it because of what they don't want, not because of what they want. And I think that's a dangerous game in life. I think we have to go towards what we want, not avoid what is uncomfortable, what we don't want. Mm-hmm. And I say that with a lot of humility because I did that. And so I don't have judgment. I just have concerns, and they're concerns for myself. I mean, the same kind of concerns you had hearing the story. Like it's not altogether a holistic choice. It might be the right choice in the moment, but it's not holistic. It doesn't look at the whole person, the whole situation, the whole family, the repercussions, the health and safety on all levels. It doesn't do that. And there are valid reasons why people do avoid providers. But it's been a really interesting experience to unpack, having been a 3-time unassisted birther to now being a veteran, several decade midwife.
You have a very interesting perspective.
I do, because I know what it's like to be alone. I know what it's like to have no one there to help you. And I know it feels like that kind of empowerment when you do birth alone. Mm-hmm. But I also have literally saved lives. And so I know the trick that can go wrong too.
Yeah. So you finally finished your training.
Yes. Well, so I went to Jamaica. I caught a bunch of babies at a hospital in Jamaica. I apprenticed a midwife in South Carolina for a hot minute. I apprenticed multiple midwives in New Jersey and Pennsylvania and Delaware and Maryland. And nobody said I was done. Well, then I went to Mexico. I caught a bunch of babies in Tijuana. And then my husband got transferred to Arkansas. And I said, no, I'm not going to Arkansas. And so I moved to Oregon. And nobody said I was done, you know, because the whole circuitous path of traditional midwifery doesn't have an end point. But I felt like I was ready, and started a group practice, opened a birth center in Oregon. And that was an amazing experience. I think because of this many preceptors and many states and many pathways and a very ambiguous kind of a pathway, and still hearing midwives in this community-based midwifery path that have been trying to become midwives for 14 years, for 10 years, it still exists that there isn't a lot of clarity. So that's been a real sort of touchstone for me in my midwifery career, is that I've tried to create structure and continuity in this process. So I've had many students in the various birth centers and clinics that I've opened. I've had many students, and I have published a student handbook that outlines the exact process of how to get through this. And I teach on the apprenticeship student model because I believe in it, but I just believe there should be benchmarks and structure so that everybody has the tools that they need to navigate the journey. Yeah.
So they can take your course and that will lead them to certification if they choose to do that.
No. So the CPM process involves a piece of didactic data, mm-hmm. so that you understand all the bits and pieces, and then a piece of clinical data, because you have to have a certain amount of experiences documented. And that seems easy, but breaking up the pieces, mm-hmm. helping knowing when to move students along That's the more complicated piece. And counseling students of how to move along, even if they have multiple preceptors, or how to get the data at the same time they're getting the experience. So I wrote a handbook on outlining the journey.
Okay.
So I have continuing ed workshops for preceptors, and I have some support for students. I do a lot of consulting for students, but I don't offer any certification.
Yeah, I gotcha. I see what you mean, but that still sounds extremely helpful.
I think so. I've gotten some really great feedback. It's a 50-page full color guide with all of the that you need to speak with a preceptor you're going to work with and work out an actual contract. And there's actually a sample contract in the back, because there's a lot of unethical lack of integrity, unfortunately, in the midwifery, community-based midwifery realm. And there's a lot of hazing. There's a lot of abuse. There's a lot of problems. And that's what happens with lack of recognition and lack of professionalism. When an organization or a whole profession is marginalized and delegitimized by the dominant culture, then the infighting within it is just as bad as it looks like on the outside, right? I feel like I've created a structure so that midwives aren't just sort of flailing around trying to find the way, both preceptors and students, because it is a relationship. So that's one resource that I feel really passionate about.
And where is this found for people listening?
Midwifereywisdom.com/shop.
Midwifereywisdom.com. Okay.
Yeah.
I will link it too. That sounds amazing. I've talked to a lot of CPMs, and this is not something I've heard them ever mention. So I love, that's great. And I really love that midwives take their questionable and or traumatic experiences and say, I don't ever want anyone to do that. And here's how I'm going to help them.
Yeah. Transformation. Transmutation. Yep. Mm-hmm. That's where we live, right?
I love it. So you went to Oregon, and then what happened?
I went to Oregon. I opened some big birth centers, had a lot of staff, a lot of students. We were doing about 20% of the volume of the hospital across the street.
Wow.
In the end. So, you know, more than 100 births a year. And I had a bunch of midwives who work for me. I had a full-time student program. We had an integrative holistic center upstairs. So we had chiropractic, massage, acupuncture, lactation therapy, Reiki, you know, all the things. We also had a nurse practitioner and a naturopathic doctor who did well baby visits. And even we even partnered with the state and had a vaccination program. And basically it was one-stop shop holistic health. And it was amazing. It was really amazing. We made a massive impact on the community. Families were so ecstatic. It was an amazing clinic, amazing opportunity, amazing process.
Is it still there?
It is not, because this is when we get into the fun politics of midwifery. So in our for-profit medical world, the hospitals don't like it when you take money out of their pocket. And that was right around the time of the ACA switch. So the Affordable Care Act came on board in 2010, but it didn't really get implemented till 2012 to 13 in many states. And in Oregon changed the most out of any state. It shifted from about 22% of my clientele being eligible for Medicaid to, after the ACA went into effect, a full 74% of the population was available for Medicaid. And I, at the time, was not a savvy enough business person to make the adjustments as they were happening real time. And so this is kind of a perfect storm story, but we had a angry, hostile doctor group at the hospital who was trying to get us out of the way because we were taking all their business. We had a massive drop in payer source. So, we suddenly found ourselves without cash flow. And every doc that took a transport of ours would turn in a complaint on our licenses. So my business paid for the defense of 39 investigations in 4.5 years. All of them are properly risk assessed patients who were transported. And we never had a bad outcome. We never had a mom or a baby have even close to a bad outcome. And we never had a complaint from patients, but it was just this incredibly litigious hospital environment, you know, fighting us. I got audited by Medicaid at the same time ACA came through, and they wanted $186,000 paid back because they changed the place on the form where you're supposed to sign, and we didn't get that memo. And then I got sued by my own licensing board for catching a baby without a medical license in the hospital. There was no doc in the room, so I thought I was doing everyone a favor not letting the baby hit the floor, but apparently that was not it. So, I filed bankruptcy and closed, and had this second kind of powerful initiation into the what not to do in midwifery. And I, as an owner, operator, provider, we make very different business decisions than as an owner, right? So for a while there, when the ACA shift was still unknown, I took clients who were on Medicaid with the hope that it would eventually work. It ended up not working. And we had over 49 clients in care that we never got reimbursed for. And as a small business, we don't have years of resources and surplus in order to make it through. And I was practicing from a place of service instead of a place of capitalism. And it just kind of was a perfect storm. I lost everything to midwifery, and I'm not sure I would want anyone to have to go through what I did, but I learned a lot. And like you said, I transformed my business experience into a very extensive re-education for midwives in business. And that's kind of my flagship course is called the Birth Business Masterclass. And it's a 6-week intensive deep dive into how to practice sustainably. But I lost, my home, my community, my income. I even lost my children because my really fantastically vindictive ex-husband filed ex parte papers for custody while I was in that massive transition. And I didn't have the money to defend it. So I was homeless for a while and living in my car, which is not something that you expect to hear.
No.
For a while, more than a year. And I am an entrepreneur at heart, so I figured out ways to teach and to train and to, you know, I thought about, you know, getting a real job. But I didn't know how to do anything else. I don't have a degree, and I don't really have transmutable skills. My friends were like, you could do phlebotomy. And I was like, yes, I could draw blood in the hospital, and then I would eventually lose all will to live. But I didn't know how to be a salesperson or sell used cars. Like, I just couldn't wrap my head around what else I was going to do. Mm-hmm. I treaded water for a while. I taught at a midwifery school for a bit. I traveled and taught online and in person, continuing ed. I wrote curriculum for Meek so that, you know, I could use my experience in my brain to help something. Mm-hmm. I worked hard on developing this online consulting business. And I feel like, you know, some people have been like, how are you a consultant? Like, didn't your business fail? And it's like, yes, that is why. Mm-hmm. I learned more than anyone would learn making lots of money. You know, like I learned all the ins and outs of how what it's like to crash and burn. And I'm helping you not do that. So I developed this whole consulting firm. And now I have in-house legal counsel and bookkeeper and design and business support. And we're kind of this one-stop shop for anything front office or back office to help people really sidestep the drama and the challenge that most midwives didn't go to business school. They don't know how to do it. And so we learned by fire. I learned trial by fire how to do it. And so that's what I created. And I discovered that I love teaching, I think almost as much or more than I love midwifing. And luckily it resonates with other people because I'm in demand, and it's such a fulfilling experience to midwives. And so that's what I do now. I've been mobile and independent, and I say houseless for 5 years now. I never did put roots down anywhere after my life imploded. And I've been traveling ever since. Helping other birth centers around the world get sustainability. And I've helped open over 35 birth centers now, most of them in the US, but globally too. And I've had hundreds and hundreds of students go through my accredited curriculums. And I'm still catching babies here and there. And I love it.
How did you get the first international position? Was it something you reached out for? Did they find you?
Kind of all of the above. So I had a bunch of things kind of in the fire at the same time. And so I started working with an Iranian midwife who has a consulting firm and coaching midwives in Persia and in Georgia and UAE. That was my one of the reasons I was going to India this year anyway. I have consulted on various startup projects, and that was where they found me. And then I have reached out to being like, I think I'll be in this country. What do you think? So I traveled Central America in 2019 and got to meet midwives and tour birth centers and have this really epic experience there. And then Robin Lim with Bumi Sihat asked me to come work for her there. We met in Hawaii. I lived in Hawaii for about a year and a half in this bit. I mean, you know, lived is a strong word because I lived in a bus I built into a house. I lived on the beach.
Basically. I mean, it's Hawaii. I think probably most people can only afford a bus.
Exactly. So yeah, I converted a bus into a tiny house and lived there. But I met Robin Lim when I was there. We'd always sent students back and forth between our clinics. I had students who would go from Trillium where I was to Bumi Sihat, but we never really interfaced. And then I was working with her midwives from when she gave birth 20 some years ago. And we just sort of hit it off, and she asked me to come to Indonesia. So I was doing that. And then the world pushed me here. So here I am.
So I have to ask, cause I'm a mommy, your babies are grown. How did they come out of all this? How are they?
Yeah, thanks for that. My youngest turned 18 yesterday.
Happy birthday.
She's in college in Washington State and very, very self-reliant, very independent. Our relationship is probably, was probably fractured the most. Because she was 14. Mm-hmm. And so we probably have many years of repair there. But we do talk at least every week, and there's a lot of love. My son is a firefighter in California, Colorado. Kind of he moves around depending on the fires, and he's a pretty typical 21-year-old, like, hey, mom, what's up? Doesn't have much to say. And my oldest lives in Las Vegas. She's a horse trainer in Las Vegas. And She's pregnant with her second baby. She's going to be 23 this year, and she's pregnant with her second baby. Back in the craziness of running that birth center, I also had a grandbaby in the house with teenagers, which I didn't really talk about. We had a baby in high school, which, you could talk about birth control from the time they're two, but you know,
but she waited. She waited for the second one, right?
She did. Yes, she did. Yeah. And my granddaughter is six, almost six, and this baby is due the same week. And I'm going to go back and help that baby like I did the first.
She had a home birth as a teenager?
She did. She had a birth center birth at my clinic.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That is a mighty, mighty young lady.
She is epic. Yep. She graduated high school on time with her class, with excellent grades, captain of her sports team, still breastfeeding. In her senior picture was breastfeeding.
Wow.
It's just like, she was a champion right from the beginning.
Yeah. I'm sure you're just so proud.
I am really proud. I'm proud of all my kids. Extensively proud of all of them. But I think it'll take me longer for the younger two to hear me, because I don't think they hear me right now. Yeah.
That's tough. You've had a lot of hurdles.
Yeah, more than I expected. And I think nothing prepares you for the experience of being kicked out of your nest, you know, which is essentially what happened. Empty nest syndrome is an interesting thing. And I was sort of a premature grandmother. I was sort of prematurely empty nested. And I'm still settling into what it's like to be me and find my path. And at the same time, feel like I don't lose connection to my history. Yeah.
I mean, you've had such a varied, cool midwifery career, but how are you today?
I'm actually very well. I mean, I in amongst all of this is a whole lot of personal work, a lot of personal growth. I think from a very young age, from that six-year-old self watching my parents sort of struggle with the loss of their son, I feel like I very early on discovered that everyone is either shrinking or expanding. And it is to continue to grow and continue to expand, continue to when you're stagnant, you're dying. You know what I mean? So living must be throwing yourself into the winds, you know? And so I sort of took that literally. And when my life imploded, I kind of call it like the cosmic 2x4, you know, because I had three teenagers. I had a baby in my house. I had 27 student or employees. And then I had another full roster of students, hundreds of patients coming through the door every day, three facilities. Like I was like really at the edge of everything, you know? And I there were many, many weeks. I worked over 100 hours a week. I lived at the birth center, just really not balanced. And I wanted out. I wanted out, but I couldn't figure out how to get out. And I always feel like the universe is like, hey, psst, there's a way out. Try this, you know, like, psst, hey, you could do, hey, are you listening? There's like this. And like, if you ignore all those cues, it's like, whack, you get the cosmic 2x4 upside the head, you know? And that's kind of what I experienced. You know, I got ejected from my life and like, then everything kind of crumbled. But then living in my car, I was like, okay, well, you have the option to go shrink and work as a car salesman, or you could expand and like really figure out what are you here to do? What is your heart here to do? And I kept asking myself the question. I would journal it and I would think it and I would dream it and I would write it and I was just trying to figure it out. And the only answer that came back through the ethers, whatever question I asked, was palm trees and blue water. And it makes no sense, you know, that I was in the mountains of Oregon, you know, with no access, that it made no sense, but I just somehow followed. I just somehow had the desire to follow it. And I was like, all right, palm trees and blue water. Cool. Where's that? I don't know. Okay. But that's what I'm going to be open to. That's a healing balm somehow. And so the moment I wrote it down in my journal, I was like, okay, palm trees and blue water. That's what I'm going for. Even though it makes no sense. Don't judge it. Don't censor. Just go. And the very same day, I had three previous students email me a job opening in San Diego. And I was like, okay, there's probably palm trees and blue water there. So I applied and I got the job and I went down there for a bit. And politically, it didn't really jive with me. But then very quickly, I got asked to come cover a call for a practice in Hawaii. So I went there and I've just been sort of following palm trees and blue waters ever since. And it doesn't really make sense, but it's led me on a really good pathway. It's, you know, it's led me on a pathway that I can live with, you know. And I do a lot of work, a lot of inner work, and I'm very resilient. I think you're either growing or expanding or you're shrinking. And every day I choose to try to grow, try to expand.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, wow. Just all of it. And we talked a little bit offline, but what are your podcasts that you have?
Yeah, I do a bunch of things. I have a podcast called Worldwide Midwifery, and we interview experts and researchers in the field of midwifery globally. And that's a really fun, it's a very, very edited, very structured podcast. So it takes me a long time to produce an episode, but I love it. And then I also co-host Help for Mothers, a podcast aimed at moms in the U.S. And my co-host is Keisha Chiappinelli, who is a JAG lawyer and an IBCLC. She's a human rights lawyer and a CLC, IBCLC counselor. And so together we kind of investigate the challenges that mothers face, which is really, it's been fun. We have a new episode coming out with the creator of the human biome, so of the microbirth group. So that'll be fun. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the podcast I couldn't find, but I'm going to dig for that because it sounds very
Help for Mothers. Yeah. There's some really good guests. We had Jennifer Margolis on our show, who is an award-winning investigative journalist about the dangers of acetaminophen. That was really interesting.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of topics because we just aimed it at moms. Like we go into fluoride and vaccines and all the things. It's really fun. And so I'm a pretty heavy social media presence. And so pretty much everything business related is Midwifery Wisdom. So you can find me on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and all those things, Midwifery Wisdom. And then my personal page is Art of Birthing. And that's the book I'm working on. So someday.
I was totally thinking that the whole time. But I don't know. I think you need a book about your life.
Mm.
Yeah.
That would be more vulnerable, wouldn't it?
It would be very vulnerable. You were very vulnerable today, but you just have a story that people can really be inspired by, number one, and learn from.
Thank you.
All of it. Thanks. From your very own birth to today.
Yeah. I feel lucky. I think the adversity is the greatest teacher sometimes. So.
Yeah. And you have a lovely voice. So I'm sure your podcast is one of those ASMR, right? ASMR, whatever.
Well, thank you. And it's such a pleasure to speak to you. I really appreciate the invitation and the space that you're holding for the new midwives of the world. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate you waking up and meeting me. I'm honored that you shared so much with me and for everybody to listen to.
Yeah. It's my honor too. And I've got clinics starting in about 7 minutes. So it's good timing.
Good. Perfect. All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you, my friend. Have a great day.